Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Podcast on Radio MD, iHeart, or wherever you download us from. Thank you for doing that. We have an interesting, unusual guest today. I usually don't talk at all about pediatrics because my wife is the developmental pediatrician and I know nothing about it. And we make sure we don't talk any medicine at home, which keeps us sane and still married after 51 years. In any case, our guest today is an expert on childhood trauma, Mark Dehauser. That's markdehauser.com if you want to go to the website. Mark Dehauser is the author of Vulnerable Minds, The Harm of Childhood Trauma and the Hope of Resilience. It's published by a division of Penguin Random House called Avery Books. We, as usual, are brought to you by Life's First Naturals, the makers of bovine colostrum, and the Truebiotic preparations of probiotics. You can go to their website, lifesfirstnaturals.com, to see the randomized double-blind controlled trials that show why they're so useful for us who are getting older, not for the children that Mark will talk about. The second is, of course, our own website, longevityplaybook.com. Go there to sign up, longevityplaybook.com. Sign up for the free newsletter, which is the latest medical news of the week in one key article, 250 words, plus a cartoon to keep you hopefully sane. Thank you, Dr. Hauser, for coming on. Tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get into childhood trauma and this area of childhood development?
Yeah, so my background is really in the basic sciences, and in particular kind of the neurosciences, both kind of cognitive and evolutionary. And for, you know, 30 or more years, that's the research I was been doing, and I continue to do, involving both kind of healthy populations of humans and non-human animals, children and older people, as well as clinical populations. About 14 years ago, I started doing work in schools, primarily, focusing on children in special education, and therefore children with different kinds of disability, among which were students with traumatic histories. And what was striking to me while the work was going on was that there was a real rift between the knowledge that was accumulating within the sciences about both the harm of childhood traumatic experiences, as well as the hopeful side of ways in which one can build resilience and help with recovery. And I was struck by the fact that not only were teachers often unaware of much of the scientific evidence, but so too were nurses, therapists, and doctors, including pediatricians. And it seemed to me that it was really important to pull together this information in a way that would be both comprehensible, meaningful, and usable by the variety of professionals that I just mentioned, as well as for potential victims and parents, realizing that this problem is a vast global problem. The World Health Organization estimates that 1 billion children annually are maltreated. So we've got a very significant problem.
It seems to me, and my model is pretty poor because I was treated so well as a child. But when I look at it, when you're adopting a dog that has had trauma in its youth, it never quite gets over that. And it doesn't seem ever to get over it. I mean, it reacts poorly in some situations consistently. And it seemed to me that childhood trauma must be at least that bad because there must be flashbacks to those events all the time. In other words, part of the book is the hope and the recovery, but it seems to me there has to be an ongoing damage for most of the people that require this. hope and recovery. In other words, that most of the kids who experience this in America probably don't get what they need to recover fully. Is that correct?
Yeah. So let me unpack that a little bit. So first of all, I like your connection to animals and dogs. So my wife's a veterinarian, and we right now have a Newfoundland that was a rescue. We're his third home. And his early experience as a puppy, going from the first home to the second one, was being beaten up by older dogs. So he was basically physically abused by other dogs in the home in the first and second cases. He had what we like to call APEs, adverse pet experiences, with the analogy being to adverse childhood experiences. And he's an interesting case because in some ways what we see in him is similar to what we see in many of the children that I work with, and I'm sure that many of the listeners have experienced. But I want to pull apart an important piece of your question, which is that traumatic responses can happen to a wide variety of different types of adversity, and the way they manifest in the child, in the same way they manifest in a dog, are going to be different. And so one of the important messages in my book is that if we're going to help with treatment and recovery, as well as building resilience against potential future adversities, we need to take into account what I call the adverse T's, five different dimensions that shape the adversity and then potentially the response to it. So type is the first one. Being physically abused or sexually abused or emotionally abused are different kinds of maltreatment as opposed to, for example, neglect or deprivation. So a child growing up in poverty may have absolutely loving parents and maybe even a loving community, but they live in abject poverty. That child is going to respond to that adversity differently from a child who was sexually abused, from a child exposed to war, from a child exposed to discrimination and oppression, and so forth. So type is one dimension. Secondly, and you mentioned at the start that your wife is a pediatrician, the timing of the adversity matters. Development isn't just this one piece of time. There are different windows of opportunity that if certain experiences are going to happen, then the child will be developing typically cognitive, social, motor capacities. The third dimension is tenure, how long it lasts. The fourth is toxicity, how severe it is. And the fifth is what I call turbulence, how predictable or controllable it is. Key point here, different dimensions of adversity will shape different traumatic signatures. By understanding those signatures, we can then design recovery methods to help build recovery and resilience. So, coming to your core question, is it the case that a child with significant traumatic experiences may never recover? The answer to that is it depends. It depends on those dimensions. So, for example, there are some very well-designed studies that grew out of Romania that started in the 1990s. These children were in very austere, severe deprivation orphanages that some of your listeners may know about. These have been very, very well studied by developmental scientists. To make a very long story and elegant science done, is that if those children in those orphanages were able to move out into good foster care homes by the age of 2.5, they largely recover all cognitive, social, emotional functions. If they last longer, some of those functions may not recover. So that's an example of where the type and timing are interacting in terms of recovery. So I think it's important for your listeners to really appreciate the nature of these dimensions of adversity for two reasons. One, if a child responds with trauma, the signature of that is going to indicate which pieces were damaged, body and brain. But some children respond to the exact same adversity resiliently. They bounce back. My father, just to give one more example, my father was a child who moved throughout Nazi-occupied France during the Holocaust. 4 years of his childhood, completely perturbed by horrific experiences. He's 92 today. Absolutely no damage from that experience of war. He was built with biology that was resilient, and he had parents that were amazingly supportive during that period. So it's important to understand the biology that both puts some people more on the vulnerable end and puts other more on the resilient end. And then, of course, the environment's going to go further to shape those.
Now, in the book, and we're talking to Mark D. Hauser, you can go to his website, M-A-R-C D. Hauser, H-A-U-S-E-R. We're talking about vulnerable minds, the harm of childhood trauma, and the hope of resilience. In your book, you give a number of stories, and I hate to ask a favorite story, but tell us about one of the stories. You've told us about the Romanian children and your father. What did your father do to recover from it, or was it just because of the resilience shown by his parents with him that led him to be more resilient? And has that been a characteristic of his? In other words, is he more than average resilient, if you would, in the face of trauma?
Yes, I think he was handed a pretty amazing biology. But in some ways, for the listeners who may have seen the movie Life is Beautiful about the father during the Holocaust who creates this kind of imaginary world for his child to protect him from the horrors of the Holocaust, my father's parents didn't do that, but they were constantly there for supporting him. And their strategies really paid off because my father's entire family was wiped out by the Nazis except for him and his parents. But he's resilient. You mentioned that you've been married for quite a long chunk of time. My mom just passed away a year ago, and they had been married 71 years. And initially, he thought he was not going to make it any further. And he has completely bounced back from that and is living his life. So I think he really was gifted an extraordinarily resilient biology that let him get through largely on his own through the Holocaust, because what he was being exposed to was his parents felt, I'm going to put you by yourself with a family during the resistance for a few months, and then we'll come pick you up and we'll move you again. That was his experience for 4 years. So he had to have a lot of internal robustness. And I see this with a lot of the children that I work with, both nationally and internationally. We do a lot of work with children who are in orphanages or what are called children's homes in Kenya. And you see children that come in that have been excruciatingly decimated. The sadness is just over the top. And some of them come in, you can see that very quickly, once they're within this environment, even if they've had 4 or 5 years out on the streets with nothing, they come into an environment which is supportive and they begin to grow and blossom very quickly because of their biology.
We're talking about the book Vulnerable Minds by Mark D. Hauser. You talk about a toolkit approach to childhood trauma. One, what is a toolkit and what is the approach?
I think this is a really important piece that it's important to consider that because of significant individual differences in how individuals respond to different kinds of adversity and also these other dimensions that I mentioned, that there's not going to be a one-shoe-fits-all approach to helping with recovery. So typically, and my guess is that many of your listeners will be familiar with various kinds of therapeutic approaches. And those therapeutic approaches are extremely important, cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, and individual therapy, and so forth. However, for many people, those therapeutic approaches may not work. Sometimes those therapeutic approaches get married to medicine, and sometimes that combination works, but sometimes that combination doesn't work. And the other piece of this is that sometimes the kinds of approaches that are necessary must be carried out within school environments or in places where there are not many therapists. For example, in Kenya, where I work, there's not a very large team of therapists. So schools can be very helpful in aiding recovery. For example, in many of the schools I work in, it's extremely important that the staff can recognize these kind of traumatic signatures, because one of the things they can help children do is help them avoid being triggered by things that have been aversive to them in the past. For example, one of the first classrooms I walked in and a little boy who was 12 years old bolted, ran out of the classroom. What happened here? And this lovely teacher came up to me and said, look, it's not you. You just happen to look a lot like his father who's been abusing him. And so for that child has basically developed an adaptive response, run away from people who are threatening. You know, the analogy here is if you're a gazelle living on the savannah and a lion attacks you, your conclusion isn't that that lion is bad. You conclude all lions are bad. And that's exactly the adaptive response for that child. But ultimately, what that child has to learn is that not all men, for example, are going to be dangerous. That child has to learn that there are other environments that can be safe for the child. They have to calm down that nervous system. And so what can happen in school, and this is the magic of schools when they're really working carefully in a trauma-informed way, is they teach that child that the environment is safe. They calm the nervous system down. They give them strategies to calm things down, to gain control of their breathing, to recognize the consistency and trust of the staff who love them and want to care for them and want to teach them. So again, that's one piece of it, what can happen in schools. And there are many strategies within there. The other part of the book that I speak to, and this is an important piece because for many of your listeners and many, many people in the world, and this comes back to the beginning that you asked, childhood trauma, the trauma it's carried, carries into adulthood, young adulthood, older adulthood. And now you've got individuals who are living with trauma from childhood. How do we help those individuals? So in the book, I talk about a lot of relatively newish strategies that can be used to basically alter kind of the wiring of the brain. And this sounds a little scary perhaps, but these are well-established techniques, some of them. So for example, there's a technique where you take a kind of a magnet that kind of is a plucking feeling to your skull. And effectively what that does is it will deactivate temporarily or tamp down the activity of certain parts of the brain. It's been well established as medically safe. And in the study that I'm going to speak to, what was done was they took individuals who had very significant visually striking trauma. So they experienced something horrific that was associated with something visually very, very powerful. Seeing a parent get shot and killed, perhaps, or in an accident, something with a very strong visual imagery. What you do is you have these individuals bring those memories back, those visual memories, and while you're doing it, the magnet is applied to the area known to be involved in visual imagery. And what you find is that as you apply this magnet, which is effectively tamping down the signal of the image, the people don't forget that they had the experience, but the intensity of the image basically is erased. It fades away. So now they're much better able to cope with what happened. Just think about all the veterans who come back from war who have suffered immensely from the things that they've been involved with, often with very powerful visuals. This is a method that could help them tamp down that so the flashbacks and these invasive memories that can completely cause them to lose sleep, to dissociate, can be hopefully tamped down. So these are just a sample of the ways in which people can tap into this toolkit because there are massive individual differences and treatment must consider alternatives because not everything is going to work for each person.
We've been talking with Mark Hauser, Mark D. Hauser, MarkDHauser.com is way to get to his website. Vulnerable Minds. This is just one aspect of the toolkit. And as you can see, there are a lot of interesting and new parts of the toolkit that can help you or someone you love who's undergone childhood trauma. And childhood trauma is so, so common. Mark, my last question, which is kind of a softball to you, how common is childhood trauma in the United States? Let's just limit it to the U.S.
I mean, it's, you know, in the millions. When you consider abuse and neglect, there are millions of children who are being exposed to things like neglect and abuse. It is common. These are not symptoms of people who are poor or people of certain religious denominations or people of certain educations, abuse, neglect, family dysfunction, mental health, incarceration. These are all pieces that children all over the United States and world experience.
And let me just add, is the bullying online that we now see in the, I guess, in the age range of 6 to 16 or something like that, maybe longer, but at least 6 to 16 in the childhood ages, does that constitute a trauma? And is that increasing the episodes of childhood trauma in your mind?
Yes, and I would just correct one piece of the language, because what you've stated is very important. Bullying, cyberbullying, is a form of adversity. Whether or not the child responds traumatically is really up to the individual in terms of how they respond. But this is a common occurrence. It's something that's being dealt with in the schools all the time. Because of the cyber aspect of it, it adds just a whole new dimension. As your readers who may read my book will see, I was very badly bullied in school from a teenage age. But that was in the flesh with real individuals who bullied me for a couple of years in my childhood. But the cyberbullying just adds on a whole new dimension. And I would just add that what teenagers went through during COVID, which was complete social isolation, was a form of deprivation. Teenagers need social interactions. What COVID effectively did as another form of adversity was it deprived them of social interactions, which they desperately need to develop appropriately.
We've been talking, as we said, with Mark D. Hauser, H-A-U-S-E-R, the author of Vulnerable Minds. And as usual, we're sponsored by Life's First Naturals, lifesfirstnaturals.com, where you can find out about bovine colostrum and why it's so beneficial if you have bloating or leaky gut or worry about decreased immunity after hard exercise and want to prevent an upper respiratory infection. Randomized controlled data, wonderful data from a set of soccer teams in Italy, as well as repeated here in the States, and also data on why it helps prolong or keep those villi in the intestine that are like your fingers in a longer form rather than as nubbins that allow leaky gut. That's lifesfirstnaturals.com. And the other sponsor is longevityplaybook.com, longevityplaybook.com, where you can sign up for the free newsletter. Mark, thank you very much, but especially our audience. We wouldn't do this without you. 50,000 of you a week can't be wrong. Thanks very much. We'll be back next week. We hope you are. This is 1196B. The B's, as usual, are guests. The A segments, the latest medical news of the week, and what it means to you. Thank you for listening.